friend who had a chance to go over to Spencer Abbey this morning. But for those of you who haven't, he is one of the elders at the Trappist Monastery, or medium elders, in Spencer, which is one of the several very large Cistercian or Trappist monasteries in this country. And most unusually has also traveled and practiced in a number of other traditions. He did a 3-month retreat here, and he practiced with Sasaki Roshi, Mount Baldy, through one terrible cold winter, and worked in learning spiritual tradition from Tibetans and various other Eastern ways of practice. And for me, in his visits and being here, has very beautifully expressed the Dharma from the tradition in which he comes, incorporating the things he's learned. One thing about schedule, it's now 10, and there were groups that were scheduled this morning at 10:30. We'll have them at 11 this morning, so there's an hour, if you take it, or more or less, a little more, or a little less, whatever you like. So I'm really happy that he got back in time to come and meet with us.
Can somebody start me off? No, sorry. Some people don't believe me when I tell them that I go to the magic monastery in order to dance. Other people, I guess, go to in order to hear a sermon or to pray or to see beautiful sights. But I go there in order to dance. God touched me the first time I went there. He made these stiff bones to dance. All night long, God beat the drum, and I danced. The next day, I beat the drum, and God danced. The preachers went on preaching, and the workers went on working, but God danced. Don't ask me what it means. What does it mean to dance? What does it mean when God beats the drum and you dance? What does it mean when you beat the drum and God dances? And are you one of the preachers who goes on preaching? And God is dancing? Or are you one of the workers who goes on working? Oh, God is dancing. All my stories are about you. What do you need to know? After 3 months, what do you need to know? And what do you need to leave here and not take home? What will you give me? What will you give me? And what is your story? We all carry around our story with us. Bore people with our story. But can you let go of your story and pick up a new story? What's your old story like? We live in our story, really. You know, I carry around a story that all blacks are such and such. And I find very verification for that. And every black I meet, I fit him into my story. And my story says my mother used to beat me, and therefore, what can you expect? Well, then I carry around that story, and I tell it to all the psychiatrists. My story. But maybe you can find a more adequate story. There was a story of Isaac Newton, a story he had, and then there was a story that Einstein had, and someone else will come up with some other story. It doesn't say the first one is wrong. It's just groping for a bigger, more adequate story. So, the old story is not wrong, it's nice, it's beautiful. But somehow, it has a way of getting in the way of a bigger story. Nietzsche says somewhere that the great enemy of truth is not a lie, but a conviction. The old story. So what would a good story be like? What would it include? Can my story, for instance, include both Christ and the Buddha? Or does it have to exclude one? Can my story include both noise and silence? What role does suffering have in my story? What role does the body have? What role do poor people have, or rich people? What role does Christ play, or what role does the Buddha play, or what role does Martin Luther King play? Is any role? What role do I play in my story? How many stories do I have? Do I dance? Does God dance in my story, or does God scowl, or what does God do in the story? Is there a monk in the story? What is the monk's role? Is there a mother in the story? What is a mother? somebody meditating in the story? What's going on when that person is meditating? Where is she? Where's the best place to meditate? I've given you a story. I've given you questions. Now I'll give you a little bit of silence. And in the silence, you can breathe in whatever you want to breathe in, and breathe out whatever you want to breathe out. And be with whatever persons you want to be with in the silence. Brief silence, but as long as you need, really. Smile, you can laugh, you can cry, you can dance, whatever you want to do in my silence. How deep will you go in my silence? Whom will you blame in my silence? Do with all your words and your thoughts in my silence. Do you appreciate my silence, and will you use it well? If you don't like my questions, will you give yourself a better question? If you don't like my story, or you don't like your own story, will you come up with a better story? What's your story like? Just a minute more. And what else do you need?
Restlessness to end all the sitting and the silence, and then wonderful opening up and communicating and finding that all these strange bodies that I got to know over 3 months were actually wonderful people, amazing people, and there was a lot of joy for a few days, and now there's sadness that I'm leaving. And I know that other people feel that too. And this has been a magic monastery, and there seem to be so many connections and so many friends in very magical ways. And yet I'm leaving, and I have some plans, but I'm not real sure what will happen. And I know in leaving this kind of situation before, there's often a period of depression, not being able to practice, not being able to meditate, a real sense of loss. And I'm wondering if you have something to say about that. There are many precious places, many precious places. Just as there are many good stories, and not just one. And it's very important to know that there are many good stories. And there are many precious places. One precious place is the Valley of Tears. Another precious place is the place where you're alone. Really alone. And another precious place is the place where you're together. Another precious place is the place where they don't appreciate you. Very valuable place. And then there's the place where they appreciate you.
And it's a place where the incense is. That's a good place. And there's another place where they don't want any incense. So you walk to the different places. And I think that you do well to take the responsibility for maintaining contact with persons or places that remind you not simply of the one place that you think is valuable or the one story that you think is valuable, but you keep contact with the persons and places that remind you that there are many beautiful stories and there are many valuable places. So the trick is appreciation. So the person who can help remind you to appreciate the place where you are. A valuable person. And if you can do that with someone else, marvelous. There's the magic monastery, and then there's the physical monastery, and then there's the real monastery. And someone else, something you say? To die, means to fight, means to laugh, to dance, to weep. I guess I think of the analogy of holding on to another person. See, I think of the dance that way, actually, of dancing with another person or a number of persons. And the nature of the dance is you don't stop. You keep adjusting constantly. If this other person does this, then you do this. You just don't get mad at them and stay there. You move. And so the commitment to life, I guess, it's a very dreadful thing that you speak about, to keep adjusting, to keep moving and not to succumb to the pout. And not simply escape, or try to escape. And go to the place where there's no turmoil. Not determining to run off to that place where there's no noise, or there's only appreciation. And to stay under the bow tree, and not to stay under the bow tree. There's a difference between before the bow tree and after the bow tree, where before he was dividing up, this is good and this is bad, and he was searching. What he had was no good. He was searching for something else. And under the bow tree, seems to me he gave up that, and he realized that what he had was okay. And then he was free. And he expressed that by wandering all over northern India for 45 years. So no matter what he came up against, it was all right because he'd already come to terms with it. He was committed to life. He didn't withdraw. He didn't search, despising what I have now in favor of something in the future. But he was committed to the living in each day with each event and each person. And he was outside of himself because he was given over to the needs of other people. So he wasn't withdrawing from life, which is connection, which is relationship, in favor of peace for me. I wish I could take you back with me to ask me that question every day. You know, what does it mean to be committed to life? Because monks are like everybody else, they forget. They forget good. Maybe life means to breathe in and to breathe out. And maybe it means to use your muscles. The muscles to smile and the muscles to weep. And the muscles of the body and the muscles of the imagination. And the muscles that reach into the past and the muscles that reach into the future.
Suddenly became aware of an aesthetic dimension that created a different reality. As I sit and watch you, I mean, there's a difference between Father Theophane Azur Baran painting and Father Theophane El Greco, and it creates a totally different reality. And your monastery changes as I see you through one set of eyes and through another set of eyes. I don't know what the question is. Could you talk about that?
Mm-hmm. It's the nature of art and the nature of a story. It's not... it's got its own emotional tone. And we never look without an emotional tone, but the emotional tone that we carry around with us, we assume that's reality, that's something to do in reality. And we don't see the possibility of another one. And so we really are so much in need of other people to help us with our story. I just got finished visiting a number of monasteries and you could take away a variety of stories. One is that a pathetic story, you know. The monks are sitting in the midst of so much and they don't know it. They just don't know it. I mean, they're feeling sorry for themselves, just like anybody else. That's the whole story, is poor me. And some other monk is, you know, he's got the same physical realities, but he's got a bigger, beautiful story, you know? And it's not a falsification either. It's not that he's adding to it. But it's the critical enlightenment when you either see this or you see this. You know? Same physical thing is there. And that's the difference between an artist and somebody else. And it's a question for us all our lives long, you know. What about your story? What about beauty? What about bigness? How big? How small? And you can feed a person's story in the sense of keeping the person locked in the story by accepting the story. You know, and just stay there and kind of work out details within that story. Or you can assist the person to slip out a bigger story. But you have to have a bigger story, I guess, yourself. In one of the monasteries I visited, my first crack of the church, it was a big old church, somebody came in to play the organ. And the person with me was disturbed because the other person was practicing the organ. And I was utterly thrilled because he was a master of the organ. And a big, massive organ, big church. And I thought to myself, yeah, that's it. And a lot of people don't know it. That this is part of it. It's not the whole story, but part of it, part of the whole culture for monks and Christian churches is that tradition of a big organ played big. You know, you fill it, and the theologian doesn't have a clue the value of that. You know, I think that's important. And you'll be teaching religion to children and you don't have a clue, you know, but that's part of it. And the vestments and the chant and all that stuff, it's part of it. And if you can enter into it without resentment and without a lot of funny ideas, then you can expand your... But I think you tend to need every once in a while a Buddhist critique to come along and say, it doesn't mean a damn thing, you know? And they're both right. But that's what it means to dance. You know, you're here and then you're there and you're the other place. And that's what it means to be alive. It means to dance. It means here and there and the other place. But it's very much anti-life to get just one story. And you can see that in yourself, and you can see it in like the American story, or you see it in, you know, the Catholic story, or, you know, all sorts of stories are one. They're okay, they're true as far as they go, but they're only one story. See, if somebody's in the mental institution and he thinks he's Christ, or well, the only problem is he's locked into one story. He is Christ, but you know, he's just locked in the wrong way to the one story. So I think that one of the major functions of words is to destroy words. a new story to share, to expand from the old story, and music to get beyond the limitations of the words, language, and the ritual the same way. I've been working with Jean Houston, and she makes a lot of use of ritual. Like this past year, she used Egyptian and Greek rituals and mythology. The great effect, I mean, really does a marvelous job with it. Next year, she wants to do Hinduism and Buddhism, and the following year, she wants to do Judaism and Christianity. And I think that by that time, people will be open to using well Judaism and Christianity, because they'll be loosened up from their dogmatic stance, which is either enslaving or it's got a lot of resentment in it. They'll be able to enter into that and feel the beauty and let it work on them after they've been loosened up by Egyptian and Roman, Hindu and Buddhist. A lot of us have to really get away from the thing we grew up in, I think, because somebody is, for some good, with best of intentions, has deprived us of the beauty of it and the depth of it. And we end up with a certain amount of resentment. And we have to be free. And then maybe we can look back and appreciate it. You might want to think about what's the most beautiful thing you've ever seen. Somebody say something funny now. Funny question. A superficial question. How about superficial? Okay.
Earlier today, you were talking and mentioned something about making a difference in the world.
Oh, yeah.
Can you say something in terms of Buddhism?
Yeah.
Do we make a difference?
Yeah, last night, about 8 of us from my monastery went to hear Werner Erhard in Boston. And he was talking for 3 hours about that, making a difference. Can you make a difference? And he was saying really that you can easily get bogged down in the question. And if you do, you tend to get stuck in the doubt. Oh, no matter what you do, it's not going to make a difference. The problems are too big and so on. And who am I? And so he stayed, he's a rather philosophical kind of guy. He stayed a long time in that, just bringing out that dilemma, the form of suffering and meaninglessness. You know. And then suggested that you go down totally into the meaninglessness and the emptiness and the hopelessness. Just really let it in, really stop kidding yourself about doing something, making a difference. You know. And you get a feel for it. You know, trivia. I mean, you know, whatever I do. And you stay there, personally you stay there, and then you swing around and catch yourself making a decision, you know? The creative act, something out of nothing. The courageous act of not longer sitting there and speculating about it or raising a question, but proceeding to make a difference. Yeah? And it's something out of the realm of knowledge into the realm of love. It's the point there with the Buddha under the Bo tree. You know, what was going on so thoroughly through the 45 years and all the years from it, of that There's a lot of activity. I mean, everybody, all sorts of people are doing things. I've got this story about the parish priest who goes on retreat, and he says, goes to the Magic Monastery, he says, there's a monk there who will never give you any advice, but only a question. But they say his questions can be quite valuable. So I went in to see him, and I said, well, I'm a parish priest, and I've come here on retreat. I wonder if you could give me a question to help me with my retreat. So the old monk says, well, okay, your question is, what do they need? So I went away and I sat in my room and I thought about his question and I meditated and I wrote answers down, and then I meditated some more and I wrote some more answers. But actually I was disappointed with his question, and finally I went into him and I said, well, thank you very much. Your question has been helpful. I've been meditating on it now for a couple hours and it's been profitable. But perhaps I didn't make myself clear when I came to see you. When I came here on retreat, I wasn't intending to think so much of my apostolate, my work, but rather my own spiritual life. And with that in mind, I wonder if you could perhaps give me another question. So he said, well, I see. And in that case, your question is, what do they really need? Whatever that means, I don't know. What does somebody else want?
So, what's the thing that hurts most?
Me? I'm not sure if it's most, but a lot. The thing that occurs to me is to be misinterpreted. Suspicion I find very difficult. It tends to slow me down a lot. But that's a good place, I was saying before.
What makes you happiest?
Appreciation, I appreciate. I appreciate when people like me. I've been very happy in this room. Very happy in this room, in my 3-month retreat. Heaven, hell, and purgatory, you know? They exist. I know. I've been there. But a lot of heaven, and I was very happy here, and I'm very happy to come back here. I love the place, but I love the room especially. I don't know what that means.
Would you do it again?
Yeah. I don't know, this year and this year's retreat and last year's retreat, I think I prefer this year's retreat. From what I heard about, you know, the way it went last year and the way it went this year. On the other hand, up in my place, I'm kind of free, and I'm not much for people locking other people in. You know, at Avis, they try hard. They try harder. Well, we're kind of that way. We try hard. And we pester one another and get in one another's way. I'd like to come for a retreat.
Could you share with us what your practice is like?
I do a good bit of this. I like breathing very much. So I just do that very simply, and then I also do a variety of things with the breathing. Like Dafri John is strong. I like Dafri John a lot. He's strong on you just breathe in the energy and life, and you breathe out whatever your toxins or negative stuff, you know. So I like that a lot. I like very much Goenka's stuff, the physical sensations, simply. I also, another thing I do is I take my brethren like a metta meditation. I've got my brethren, I've got the roster of them located in different parts of my body. And I just kind of go there and stay with them for a while in a metta meditation. And then I kind of spot the negative stuff related to them. In some ways it's desensitizing. But that's where I've got Father Father George. And I've got Father Pascal over here. And he's over here. Then the retired abbot is, the old retired abbot is here, then the next retired abbot is there. And Father Owen is here. And then he's got the seniors. Father Owen's a senior, and then Father George is next, and then there's when I was out at Mount Baldy, they're very macho out there, you know, it's dreadful. And they, you know, you're always walking out, you're walking outside, and it's in the snow, and you're bare feet, and your sandals, and you don't never put on gloves, that's for women, huh? And you don't put on a hat or anything like that. So it was really dreadful, tough. Well, the Jikijitsu, the one who was the leader in the meditation hall, was a young monk. He was about 3 years a monk, and he had been a Catholic monk or novice somewhere, but he had been only into the Buddhist thing about 3 years. And he had a bald head. He's sitting right next to the big window, and he would open that window, you know. And I was way down in the end, I was freezing, and he had the window open. Oh. And I thought to myself, no mature professed monk would ever open the window beside himself. I mean, you know, you open the window beside someone. And sure enough, during our retreat here, we had one of these monks. He was a European, but he'd been a monk in the East there for quite a few years. I watched him one day go across the room and open the window behind someone else. So you give in to hindrances, I don't know. that's not a very good answer, but it's true.
None of what you mentioned as being a practice in any way sounded to me like what I imagine Christianity is or what a Christian monk would do. Maybe it's just that I've got some really weird ideas about what Christian monks do.
Mm-hmm. Well, Christian monks have their chanting and they have their manual work, such as Karma Yoga. And they had a good tradition of chanting, and the Gaurangian chant worked very well. It's been disrupted the past 20 years. It's hard to find something suitable in English. And then they have a lot of leisure. They have, you know, 4 or 5 hours leisure during the day. In the old days, we had so much silence, there wasn't much you could do in the leisure time. And all we had was spiritual books. Nowadays, they can spend more time gabbing, and they can read books that are not that helpful. And you often do, you know. So you waste time. So what do Christian monks do? They waste time. What do I do? My principal practice is to waste time. That's what's nice about the discipline of Barry here, you know. Great. Until you get on the staff and then and you eat junk food and you waste time. But it's part of the beauty of this place. I really appreciate that the staff is somewhat like the lay brothers that we had in our tradition, who take pride in doing the work so others can do the meditation. And they also, they have a nice discipline about them where their dissipation takes place behind the walls. I mean, they, you know, they don't eat the junk food in front of you people, and they don't spend their time gabbing and laughing and carrying on in front of you people, but behind the walls, and it's nice. There are different stories and the different places that are beautiful. And time is running out. And one more question. Right?
How was that decision made, like, for yourself in your earlier years? The monastic tradition was much more strict, and all those years of silence. Who made the decision to come out more? Like, you travel around and teach, and you go to these different things. Was that made for you, or was it made by the abbot or your bishop? Or?
We have our form of government is absolute autocracy. Just one abbot runs everything, makes decisions, basically. Absolute autocracy, modified by the insubordination of its members. The marvelous system. What happened was we had a lot of contact with Suzaki Roshi. He's been coming to our monastery for the past, I don't know, 15 years maybe. Every year gives a sesshin there nearby, and the monks go, maybe 10 of the monks go, and lay people come. So I've been into that, and I had read a lot about Hinduism, and I had made a couple of retreats in this tradition before Barry was set up. So about 7 years ago, there came a request from Rome that the monks help out with dialogue with the East. And the reason, I think, was that the Catholic Church has been trying to be in dialogue with all different religions the past 20 years or so, having less success with Hinduism and Buddhism, because I suspect they kind of look down on us. And the people in Rome finally got the bright idea, well, maybe the monks would understand them better and they might appreciate the monks better. So we asked the monks to help out with this dialogue. So that was my opportunity. And I cast longing eyes on Barry, and I said, well, gee, if I volunteer to do this, I'll have this opportunity to make a long retreat. So I volunteered to spend a year learning the Buddhist meditation. So I spent 3 months here and 3 months at Mount Baldy. I asked Ram Dass about my plans. I saw him several months before. And I told him I was thinking of coming here in Mount Baldy and then going to India. He said, perfect. He said, you know, Barry, best place in the country. That's really the place to go. You know, you learn so much there, Barry. And Suzaki Roshi, he said, that guy's so acute, he'll take things away from you you never suspected you had. You know? And then he said, India, everything's education over there. So that's what I did. I started here, and then I went to Mount Baldy, and I got the flu and pneumonia and anemia and everything at Mount Baldy. So I had to recuperate for a couple months. And then I wanted to get in a retreat workshop with Gene Houston, and I did that. And that was very expensive, and I appreciated it so much. I asked her if I could do the advanced one a month or so later, and that used up the money I had for going to India, so I never did get to India. But when I came back here, Manindra told me, oh, don't go to India at all, just come back here. This is better than India, Barry. So that's how I don't get around. I don't do much teaching, really. I'm not much into teaching. I'm more into learning. I go to a place and study under Suzaki or somebody, and that's.
But you indicated you only had a year.
I had a year at that time, yeah. And since then I've done several things, and one of them was, this was the beginning of an exchange program with worked out with the Dalai Lama, whereby his monks would live in our monastery for a while and our monks would go and live in theirs. So I took the first one around to the monasteries. It had various side advantages. I'm on the board for this dialogue, and it enabled me to find out what's going on in the monasteries and what their feeling is, and who knows something about it and who doesn't, and who's interested and who's resisting it. Sorry. Huh? I don't know. One complication is my doctor doesn't want me to spend more than a month over there. He's afraid he might not be able to bring me back to health. So maybe I should let someone else go and spend longer.
Are you still writing, Father? You got another
book? Yeah, I write. I'm lazy. It's tough writing. Yeah.
Is there another book of stories?
Well, yeah, I've got a number of stories. I'm not so satisfied with. I think, you know, one of the problems is after my book got published, I got into the mode of a teacher. And I didn't write them that way at first. They were more meditations. They weren't for anybody else. They were just reaching down. I set myself a problem or a dilemma or a question, and then in the next 10 or 15 minutes, I'd have to find the solution for it, you know? And I wasn't thinking of teaching anybody else. But now I think I'm thinking of teaching somebody something or other, and impressing them, or they like it, and all this stuff. It doesn't work too good. But if you have any bright ideas on how to break back into that other creative space, you know, where you're just kind of alone with truth. A person is never the same in a three-sided room as he is in a four-sided room. You know, a three-sided room is a stage, and that's where we live most of our life. We're concerned about what people think, or might think, or may think, ought to think. You know, in a four-sided room, that's the creative place where you just open yourself up to God. You know. Goodbye. Thank you. Thank you. I'll hang around throughout the day. Huh? Yeah, I'll hang around today.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.